Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Everybody knows that in 1919, some number of the Chicago White Sox, perhaps as many as 8 of them, conspired with gamblers to rig the World Series. It's no secret that throughout his career, Gaylord Perry loaded up his pitches with whatever he could find that might make them behave in ways that confused the men toward whom he threw those pitches. In The Dark Side of the Diamond, subtitled Gambling, Violence, Drugs, and Alcoholism in the National Pastime, Roger Abrams demonstrates that those vices and others have been present in baseball pretty much since the first time two teams played the game. When we spoke recently, I invited him to tell me about the first ball player to use testosterone injections in order to enhance his performance.
Well, it was a Hall of Famer whose name was Jimmy Galvin, known generally by the fans as Pud Galvin, and the first 300-game pitcher that was nearing the end of his career was looking for something that might make a difference. And the newspapers of the time had lots of information about this new elixir of life that was created by a French-American physiologist. And so apparently, Galvin, who played in Pittsburgh for the then Pittsburgh Alleghenies, went to the local hospital and got an injection of testosterone. This was August of 1889.
Mr. Galvin must have been one desperate pitcher because he agreed to be injected with an extract of the testicles of a guinea pig and a dog, and I gotta think that maybe things weren't quite as clean in the hospitals of that day as they are now, I'm guessing.
That is true. And in fact, Galvin only played for a couple more years. But the Washington Post reports that the day after he took this injection, he had one hell of a day.
Oh, he won. Oh, he was a great victory.
It was,
yes.
It was against Boston. It was a shutout, and he got a couple of extra base hits. This was unusual for Pud Galvin. But my guess, it was the placebo effect.
Drug use among the ballplayers of the late 19th and early 20th century was not limited to testosterone. What were some of the other substances to which early hitters and pitchers turned?
Well, they would turn to anything that seemed to work. Ballplayers at the time were paid only if they played. And it was a long season with clubs that only had 10 or 14 people on the whole club. And so to deal with the pain, there was alcohol. In addition, they would take all kinds of mixtures of strychnine. Cocaine was...
Strychnine jumped out at me. I don't know why. I kind of thought that was something that killed people.
Well, it, you know, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger.
Okay.
And that was the hope of these baseball players. But they were a tough bunch. They didn't have any of the power drinks that we had today, but they had the functional equivalent.
And the cocaine came in easily ingestible
potions. I mean, you just go down to the local grocery store, get your cocaine. It was perfectly legal, and heroin, and sometimes it was mixed with wine, and that was really quite nice, I'm told.
When Ty Cobb coached a high school all-star team, he taught the youngsters how to cheat creatively. Rogers Hornsby, another Hall of Famer, was quoted in 1961 as saying, "You have to cheat. If I had played strictly by the rules, I'd have been home feeding my bird dogs a long time ago." Would today's fans be less upset by the use of steroids by contemporary players and by other forms of cheating if they knew the game's history?
I think, in part, what it does is it places today's contretemps into a historical context. That doesn't excuse what might be going on today, but it does explain it as part of the game, that the game includes the glories of Ted Williams' home run and the perfidy of the 1877 Louisville Grays who threw the pennant. I think as you look through the history of our national game, what you see is America, both in its glories and in its vices.
You must have had a heck of a time researching some of the stuff that you found, and I'm sure you went into this project quite knowledgeable about baseball, but what did you find that shocked or surprised you?
I was surprised at the extent of the problem of gambling and game fixing during the 19th century. All of us grew up learning about the 1919 Black Sox. They were a terrible group. They did throw the World Series, although there was an effort to get Cincinnati to throw it as well, which would have been really fun to watch.
The series might have gone on forever.
Forever. What I did not know, and what was of equal magnitude in terms of a scandal, were those 1877 Louisville Grays. The National League had just been founded the prior year with a promise that this game was going to be perfectly clean. And lo and behold, some gamblers had paid them off to lose the pennant. Then I found the first game that was ever fixed was in 1865, long before there was any official professional baseball. All the players were paid under the table or had jobs for which they didn't have to work. It was a game between the New York Mutuals and the Brooklyn Eckforts. And the Mutuals, clearly the best team in the New York area where baseball started, lost the game on purpose. And I couldn't understand why they did that until in further research I found that the owner of the club of which the Mutuals were the pick team was William Boss Tweed.
The subtitle of your book is Gambling, Violence, Drugs, and Alcoholism in the National Pastime, but the book is not without its lighter moments, at least if those moments are considered in retrospect. One of those moments involved a woman named Alice Roth. She was a Phillies fan who one August day in 1957 must have left the ballpark really wishing that she'd been somewhere else.
Well, she did leave the ballpark on a stretcher. Hmm. Now, that does happen. It happens more than the media reports. Every year at Fenway Park, dozens of people are hit by foul balls and are injured as a result. And that happened to Alice Roth. She was put on a stretcher. The batter was still at bat.
It was Richie Ashburn, I believe.
It was the great Richie Ashburn. Right. And only Ashburn could have done this, certainly not on purpose. As they were carrying her out, Ashburn hit another foul ball right in the region of Mrs. Roth and hit her a second time.
This is not something one should laugh at. What are the odds?
Well, you know, just take care when you go out this season. Be careful.
I hope he gave her a signed baseball bat or something.
Well, she has found her memorial in my book.
You're perhaps aware that this program, Only a Game, sometimes sinks to doggerel. According to your research, in 1886, the Atlanta Constitution ran a bit of same, and it begins, "Mother, may I slug the umpire? May I slug him right away so he cannot be there, mother, when the clubs begin to play? Let me clasp his throat, dear mother, in a dear, delightful grip with one hand and with the other bat him several in the lip." Were umpires in the game's early days in more danger than today's umpires are?
Well, in the very early days of the game, when there was nothing to restrain the spectators. If they didn't like the call, they would just go right up to the umpire and complain vociferously. Umpires interacted with the crowd in the beginning and in the very earliest days of the games in the 1840s and 50s and 60s, umpires would sometimes turn to the crowd to get advice on a call.
Oh, excellent.
And, you know, then they would say, okay,
what could possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong? But there came a time as the game became a bit more violent when a person's in the crowd, spectators would not just hurl epithets at the umpires, but would hurl bottles and other paraphernalia that could hurt. Most of the umpires took this, although not necessarily calmly, but there are some umpires, like Tim Hurst, who is in the Hall of Fame, who attacked his attackers with a bat, and they were not soon to return to the ball yard.
We haven't talked about gambling, the first of the four vices you mention in the subtitle of your book. It's interesting to me that you conclude that Pete Rose, banned from baseball for placing bets on games when he was managing the Cincinnati Reds, should eventually be elected to the Hall of Fame.
Well, there is no question, based on his performance on the field, that Pete Rose is a Hall of Fame.
More hits than anybody else.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And more everything. So more games, more at-bats, more outs, in fact. His name is all over the Hall of Fame. And so there's no question he is there. Before this incident, the voters at the Hall of Fame, either the baseball writers or the Veterans Committee, never considered activities of the candidate that occurred after he ended his playing career. Pete's activities, which were certainly censurable, there is no question in anyone's mind that he bet on the games in which he managed. But those events occurred after he stopped playing. And so by Hall of Fame tradition, it should not be considered. Second of all, we should recognize that the Hall of Fame is not a Hall of Angels. He would have plenty of company in the Hall of Fame from people who I would characterize, well, John McGraw, bet openly on the 1905 World Series, which he won, and so he won his bet. But he is there, as are many others. Pete Rose deserves to be elected to the Hall of Fame, but never again in a clubhouse or in a managerial position.
What about Mark McGuire, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens?
We'll have to see on those. I think our fever with steroids will be subsiding. As I've said publicly on many occasions, anyone who takes steroids now is too stupid to play the game, and steroids are over. Then what do we do with the folks during this era? We are going to have some finality on some of those matters. Bonds has a criminal trial. And if Bonds is acquitted, he's in the Hall of Fame, I think. If Roger Clemens wins his libel suit against Brian McNamee, he's in. If everything is left hanging, well, that's why eligibility for the Hall of Fame extends for a period of years. Every era has its own quirks. Those who were admitted to the Hall of Fame before 1945 didn't play against any players of color. And at the same time, they didn't have the same kind of nutrition as current players. Every era is different. This era allegedly is different because of both steroids and human growth hormone. We'll have to see if there is proof that those activities had any more effect on those players' ability to perform than it did for Pud Galvin in 1889.
Roger Abrams is the author of The Dark Side of the Diamond, Gambling, Violence, Drugs, and Alcoholism in the National Pastime, published by Rounder Books. Mr. Abrams, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure, Bill.
My conversation with Roger Abrams, the author of The Dark Side of the Diamond, will be featured on Saturday's show. I'll also be talking with our college basketball guy, Pat Forty, since the rumblings of the agitation that will soon bloom into the madness associated with March have already begun. Accordingly, we'll have a story about Duke and North Carolina, known to stage basketball games of some significance, and we'll learn about a hoop dancer who's headed for Hollywood. I'll be reading from your letters, too, so join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.